Moving on to item six, we're going to move into the private equity review, and we're going to kick it off with our own staff comments. So Tim, I'm going to give the floor back to you to tee up the private equity discussion.
Sure. Rishi's going to come on and give an overview of our process and our activity and talk a little bit about where we've been, where we're going, and then we'll turn it over to StepStone to do a performance review and a pacing recommendation.
Okay, excellent. So I see Rishi has joined us. Good morning.
Morning, everyone.
So the floor is yours.
Okay. Let me share my screen. Can everyone see that?
We can.
Okay, great. So it's time for our annual more detailed review of Cicero's private equity program. Today, I'm going to cover the private equity program and the private equity strategy sections here relatively quickly. I've discussed those sections in detail in last year's presentation. And then I'll spend more time on the projected investment pace and private equity portfolio subcategory sections this year, and then finish off with key takeaways from my presentation. And following my presentation, I'll hand it off to the StepStone's private equity team, and they'll discuss a market update, pacing projections, and portfolio performance.
Okay.
So, please feel free to jump in with any questions while I'm presenting. I'll also pause during the presentation for questions.
Well, this is a shy group, Rishi, so you just have to put up with it.
Okay, so moving on to page four, you saw a similar slide to this in my presentation last year. Private equity is in the growth bucket for Cicero's portfolio, and the board approved an increase in the private equity allocation from 11% to 15% in December 2020. The key participants in the private equity program, so no material changes to the slide from my presentation last year, but as a quick refresher, Cicero investment staff uses delegated authority to implement the private equity program. Staff leads top-down strategy selection, bottom-up manager selection, and monitoring of investment managers. Staff establishes direct relationships with private equity managers to implement the program. And StepStone is responsible for portfolio monitoring, reporting, and pacing analysis. Onto page seven now. So again, this section for the private equity strategy, there are no material changes to this section from last year, which we view as a positive thing. Our goal is to maintain a consistent and disciplined core private equity strategy as long as it's working. We manage the program according to a pacing analysis and take both a top-down and bottom-up criteria into account when evaluating investment opportunities. Investment opportunities where we have strong rationale, both from a top-down and bottom-up perspective, will end up being our highest conviction opportunities. Our top-down areas of focus are similar to what I showed in the presentation last year. Though we're still largely focused on building out our primary fund exposure in North America, we track a few European and Asian funds, and we're open to select opportunities in those geographies. For example, this year we took an in-depth look at a European fund, but decided not to move forward ultimately. We remain multi-sector focused and continue to focus on primary fund implementation, primarily in buyout funds, as we continue to build out the core of Cicero's primary fund portfolio. Our bottom-up areas of focus, also consistent compared to my presentation last year, we're looking for established managers that have persistent first and second quartile performance over multiple macroeconomic cycles with low loss ratios and a relatively tight range of return outcomes. And we try to do all this while not sacrificing upside and returns. In early 2019, shortly after I joined the team, we fine-tuned our private equity strategy and began implementing Cicero's core primary fund investment strategy. Since 2019, we've completed 8 commitments to 6 new managers, all using delegated authority, and we've committed $380 million in the aggregate so far.
Hey, Rishi, hold on just a second. Jay, you had a question or a comment for Rishi?
Yeah, sorry, just a quickie there. For context, can you also, Rishi, have you guys tracked how many funds you're actually doing due diligence on? Like, I'm curious, you know, given kind of the other proposals later in the meeting, as well as the obvious higher increased workload ahead, there's already a huge workload, isn't there, in kind of just keeping the current allocation pace going?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Jay. There is, and so I'd say we do track it. So you know, at a high level, there's sort of, I'd say, a first level sort of screening level. Maybe there are 20 to 30 funds per year, depending on the pipeline in a particular year. After that initial screen, maybe we'll whittle that down to closer to 10 funds, where we'll initiate some sort of interaction with the general partners. And then from there, you know, we're shooting to try to make a commitment to 3 to 4 funds a year right now, based on how the pacing might increase. You know, some of those pipeline numbers might change, but that's sort of how we've been approaching it so far.
And this, I mean, this is basically you going into like the data room, looking at the underlying holdings of the fund, doing reference checks on everybody, kind of researching past vintages, right? I mean, the full due diligence process is pretty pretty in depth.
It is, and yes, and it needs, you know, we don't sacrifice on the robustness of our due diligence process. I think in addition to the due diligence process being in depth and robust, there are also sometimes shorter time frames for us to meet as a new limited partner in these funds. So, you know, as a new limited partner in funds where managers have a lot of demand and can sort of choose which LPs they partner with, we need to try to get to an answer on sort of our level of conviction as soon as possible in the fundraising process. To try to get, you know, the small portions of allocation that are reserved for new investors. So it's not just the amount of work, it's also the compressed time frame sometimes that we need to adhere to. But thanks for acknowledging the work that's going into this. It's been fun, but it is a lot of work to evaluate these private equity funds. Is everyone still with me?
Yep, we're still with you. I don't see any other hands up right now, so go ahead and continue, Rishi.
Great. Jay preempted that. I was going to pause for questions. He preempted that, so good timing there. So moving on to the projected investment pace section, you know, so StepStone's responsible for the pacing model, and they'll show the key outputs from the pacing model and speak to it in more detail during their presentation. But I'm also going to speak to pacing a little because StepStone's pacing model is projecting a significant increase in Cicera's investment pace in the coming years in order to meet our 15% private equity target. Now, you know, before I dive into this slide, let me give you a sense for how private equity investment pacing has gone so far since I joined the team. So from 2019 to 2021. You know, at the 2019 board meeting, StepStone projects pacing for 2019 to 2021. Of $100 to $150 million in commitments per year. And the aggregate over those 3 years from the beginning of 2019 to the end of 2021 was $400 million in total commitments. Cicera has committed $380 million from the beginning of 2019 through year to date 2021 versus StepStone's projected pacing of $400 million. So we're a little behind, but roughly in line with projected pacing that was recommended when we started building the core primary fund portfolio. So that's one data point. You know, another data point worth mentioning, I think at the November 2020 board meeting, before the board had approved the increased allocation to private equity, StepStone was projecting pacing for 2021 of $125 million. The board approved the increased allocation to private equity in December 2020, and StepStone updated the pacing model, which increased 2021 pacing from 125 million to 200 million. And year to date 2021, Cicera has committed 218 million. So we've met and slightly exceeded the projected pacing, you know, despite that significant increase from 125 million to 200 million after the board approved the increased allocation to private equity. So, you know, overall at this point, I'm happy with the pacing we've been able to achieve, you know, especially given the quality of the portfolio we've been able to build, and the fact that we're building, you know, a primary fund program from scratch, and we're having to source and build multi-year relationships for Cicera to access the best private equity managers in the market. Now, turning to the slide, you can see that investment pace is projected to increase from, you know, 200/300 million per year to $450 million per year over the next 5 years. The biggest drivers of the increased investment pace are larger Cicera total plan size than was projected, and higher cash distributions in Cicera's private equity program than was projected. The larger plan size, you know, hopefully is relatively easy to understand, straightforward. 15% target of a larger plan means we need a larger private equity program. So, and that in turn drives increased investment pacing. Now, in terms of increased distributions, Cicera has had two record private equity distribution years in the history of our private equity program in 2020 and year to date 2021. And StepStone's pacing model is projecting higher distributions going forward than was originally projected. So as investments are liquidated and cash is distributed or returned to Cicera, Cicera then has to reinvest that cash to reestablish the exposure to private equity. So higher distributions to us drives the need for more dollars to be reinvested, which in turn drives increased investment pacing.
Sorry, Rishi.
Go ahead.
On the increased investment pace, a big part of that is making sure that, I mean, we're just not throwing money into the pool, right? I mean, it's the intense search for really quality investments. So with if there's a lot of money chasing private equity, it makes it harder to get into the higher quality funds. So that's kind of a limiting factor, right? I mean, if we can't find the good funds to get into, then we just have to sit on our hands until they're available. Is that correct?
That's right, David. And so you've preempted the conversation here. You know, I think increasing from this 200/300 million pacing that we were planning for to $450 million in the short term, I see challenges with us being able to do that, you know, responsibly while still building a high quality portfolio. And so, yeah, I think more realistically, I think this sort of $200 to $300 million pacing for the next couple of years, I think that's more realistic for us. I do think we're going to be able to get to $450 million in pacing responsibly, and call it, you know, the medium term, so after the next couple of years. But you hit the nail on the head. Pacing is one driver for our program, but portfolio construction and choosing the right investments is also very important. And so we need to sort of balance these two priorities, because it is important to put capital to work, you know, also, but we want to do it in the right opportunities.
Well, you know, just to follow on that, I guess I want to drill into this a little bit. Is the issue one of, if you had more resources, more people, more capacity, that the higher tier deal is out there to be had? It's a question of being able to get to it, or is it that there's a limited amount of higher quality deals, and it's, you know, that's a constraint that we have to deal with, and maybe yeah. It's a combination.
Yeah. So I think there are a few things. So first off, you know, because we're starting a primary fund program from scratch in some ways, all of the new investments we make are with new managers. So the 8 commitments we've made, 6 have been to new managers. In order to build those relationships with those new managers, it has taken multi-year sourcing. So, you know, some managers we made commitments to in 2021, I reached out to late 2018, beginning of 2019, and we finally made a commitment in 2021. So one one thing worth keeping in mind is just sort of the life cycle of building these relationships. So it's not easy to switch on and ramp up very quickly from 200 to 300 million to 450 million. Now, one piece of that is, you know, we not only are we having to go out and build those relationships, we also have to do the due diligence and execute. And so when we're doing due diligence and executing, the relationship building is a little bit on hold. And if we had more resources, maybe we could balance these two things of executing while still maintaining the relationship building piece of it. So I think that's one piece. I think the second piece here is that we're a very young primary fund private equity program right now. And so we don't have a lot of re-ups or second or third commitments to the same fund managers, right? And when we make those re-up commitments, we're able to leverage the relationship that we built. We're able to leverage the due diligence, some of the due diligence we did previously. And so it allows us to put more capital to work while by leveraging the work we've already done. But we're not quite there yet. You know, and that's why I say in the medium term, I think we'll be able to get to this 450 million of pacing, but as more re-ups come through. But for right now, it's not as easy. And you know, in 2021, we've made four commitments so far, and you know, it's been a pretty full year of just sort of executing. So yeah, I mean, it's been busy, but let me pause there. I'm not sure if I've answered the question well.
Yeah, I think you did. I guess I would follow on, at least from my perspective. What I'm feeling like is that putting aside the goal or the plan of what the expected percentage of the portfolio is for private equity, in terms of meeting our strategic allocation goal, it strikes me that the bigger problem is cash distributions and having to deploy them. It's one thing to say, well, we targeted 15% and we only got to 11 or 10, you know, got our best people on it, did everything we could, given all the constraints, we maxed out at 11%. It's yet another thing to say, wow, we've got 150 million in cash distribution, and we need to deploy that. So I guess my question is, what happens in that latter environment where the issue is not whether you're meeting a percentage goal, but rather you've got a lot of money that needs to be deployed and maybe can't be? What's the remedy for that, if any?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think of is building up these pipelines and sourcing relationships way in advance of when you need to put capital to work. And so, you know, you're continue to build your pipeline of private equity funds each year, even if a fund isn't coming to market in that particular year. This is a fund you've identified as a fund that you might want to partner with. And so you've built those relationships. When those funds are coming to market, they give you a little bit of a heads up. They say, hey, we're coming to market in the next 3 months. You have a little bit of time to organize yourself, organize your team, organize your resources to try to go after those opportunities. So that's what we're trying to do. The thing is we've started to do that from scratch. Another thing is sometimes, you know, we'll have three or four opportunities, and this happened this year, hit at the same time. And when those three opportunities have overlapping due diligence processes on tight timelines, if we don't have sufficient capacity at the investment team level, it's not easy for us to evaluate all of those opportunities in a way where we're able to maintain our high, you know, robust standards of due diligence and be able to put the capital to work. So that scenario is one that I hope we don't fall into because of lack of team capacity to put the capital to work. But on the other side of this, you know, we need to build opportunities well ahead of time before we need to put the capital to work. So we have sort of a stable of opportunities to go after.
Okay. Well, enough said, and I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit in terms of the staffing proposal later on today's agenda. But that's helpful to know. It's an art as much as a science, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. And so is the projected pacing model that that StepStone will show later. So our plan size has increased, meaning our total assets under management have increased. So 15% of a larger number is a larger private equity program. And then those distributions have increased in the near term. Now I'm not hoping for this to occur, but let's play a scenario out where if there's a flat level of plan assets or a slight decline, and let's say private equity distributions slow down because it's not a good time to exit, then you could start seeing these pacing numbers swing in the other direction. So it's absolutely a little bit more of an art than a science. And, we're trying to build up several years in advance to be able to implement. I think one thing on our side here is that, we're not near the 15% number yet. So let's say we see lots of great opportunities next year. I'm not concerned that we're going to overshoot our target. So if we see lots of great opportunities, we'll certainly act on them. And to David's point earlier, we could find a home for $450 million of private equity commitments next year. It's just about maintaining quality of the portfolio.
All right, excellent.
So if there aren't any more questions on investment pace, I'll move on now to the private equity subcategory section. So when the board looks at private equity performance throughout the year, you're typically looking at returns that represent the performance of the whole private equity portfolio in the aggregate. Now, that said, Cicero Investment Staff views the private equity portfolio as having a few distinct subcategories, and that together make up the aggregate private equity performance. And there are significant differences between those subcategories. So we think it's important to understand the subcategories when evaluating the impact of recent investment decisions and evaluating how the new primary fund investment strategy is performing. So let me drill down on aggregate private equity performance and show the distinct subcategories and how they contribute to overall performance. So in this table, I've shown the four subcategories that I'm going to walk through today. There are three legacy subcategories. So a legacy fund of funds, legacy primary funds in the top section of the table, and it's followed by a legacy real assets below the first subtotal in the table. And then there's one core category, which is the core primary fund portfolio, which is highlighted in green. Now the first subtotal in the table represents the portfolio excluding real assets. And the second subtotal includes real assets. And I'll explain more in a minute why I've broken performance out in this way. Now, hopefully the labeling of the legacy categories is self-explanatory. Starting at the top of the table, you can see the vast majority of the portfolio is still in legacy fund of funds. And that category drives the majority of the private equity portfolio return. At the same time, legacy fund of funds doesn't represent Cicero's current or go forward strategy, which is why drilling deeper into private equity performance can be important to evaluate recent investment decisions and performance. And the core primary fund portfolio, highlighted in green, represents Cicero's current private equity investment strategy and shows investments Cicero's made using delegated authority since I joined the team in late 2018 and we fine-tuned the private equity strategy all the way through to June 30th, 2021. It's worth noting here that we closed one commitment of $50 million in September 2021, which brought us to 8 commitments in the core portfolio. The data in this table is as of 6/30/2021 and does not include that commitment that we closed in September. So as you can see, the core primary fund portfolio is still in its infancy and doesn't make up a large percentage of contributed or invested capital. That said, it is starting to make up a more material percentage of commitments given the new manager relationships we brought on from 2019 to 2021. Sorry about this. The core portfolio also isn't contributing significantly to overall private equity performance because it makes up such a small percentage of total contributed or invested capital. Now, in terms of returns for the core portfolio, I'd expect the net IRR you see here of 70% to come down over time. The hope would be that the TVPI and the DPI continue to grow as value is created in the coming years. Keep in mind, this is still a very young portfolio, so to be marked at 1.5 times TVPI is a promising start because private equity funds typically have 10-year plus lives before they realize their full value. Now, the core primary fund portfolio is probably most relevant to monitor when trying to evaluate recent investment decisions. Now, the challenge is that this portfolio is still very young, but I'm going to try to provide a little more color on the early performance of this portfolio later in my presentation. The legacy primary funds represent primary fund commitments made by Cicera from 2004 to 2018, which is before I joined the team and before Cicera fine-tuned its core primary fund strategy. Moving on to legacy real assets, Cicera has been including legacy real assets in its private equity portfolio performance for reporting purposes to date. The board has been seeing private equity performance, including real assets. So the total at the very bottom of this table is what the board typically sees reported as private equity performance. But frankly, real assets should never have been included in private equity performance. These are very different asset classes with materially different risk return profiles and underlying assets, and so should not be lumped together in our opinion. So going forward, we plan to show real assets performance separately versus as part of private equity performance. So the first subtotal on this page shows private equity performance excluding real assets, which I think is more appropriate to monitor. And so when you see aggregate private equity performance in the future, it'll represent private equity excluding real assets, and real assets performance will be shown separately. So, on page 14, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to speak a little more about the early performance of the core primary fund portfolio. I think there are reasons for optimism in the core primary fund portfolio. I'm not going to read these bullets to you, but let me provide you with some color that I hope will be helpful. So in 2019, when Cicera fine-tuned the private equity strategy, there were a few things that staff believed. We felt it was possible to achieve first and second quartile private equity returns with low loss ratios and limited volatility. And we didn't want to sacrifice outsized returns just to limit volatility. We're focused on the fact that private equity is forecasted to be a high returning asset class for Cicera. And so achieving attractive returns is a priority in this portfolio. Now, that said, if we can limit volatility without sacrificing returns in private equity, then that's our preference, and that's what has been our goal. In order to do that, we've had to try to partner with several difficult-to-access managers, and we felt that in order to do that, we'd need to have multi-year sourcing and relationship-building strategies. We've executed on that strategy so far, and we've completed 8 commitments to 6 new managers. I'm happy with the portfolio managers we've been able to put together. Though it's still very early, I think there are reasons for optimism that what we are building towards, that we are building towards our goal of attractive returns at low volatility. So firstly, private equity, and you heard before, private equity's had a banner year also in terms of returns, and that's great for the asset class. That said, our goal was always to try to be within the first or second quartile of private equity performance. So not just to ride the wave of good private equity performance due to market forces, but to be towards the top of the performance in the asset class. I'm happy to say that although it's still early, all of our managers are currently first and second quartile managers, and the portfolio has a 0% loss ratio. So what that means is that none of our active funds are marked below cost. But also, importantly, none of the portfolio companies within any of those funds are marked below cost. So consistent performance with low volatility. I think it's important to keep in mind that benchmarks are not as meaningful early on in the fund's life. So these are metrics we'll need to continue to track. But I wanted to give you a sense of how the portfolio is shaping up in these early days. And I think there are reasons to be optimistic and some early evidence that what we've been shooting for since early 2019 is starting to come together. Okay, and so finishing up with the key takeaways, our sourcing and investment strategy appears to be working, increasing significantly, being projected to increase significantly to reach our 15% target. There's promising early performance of the core primary fund portfolio. And we think when monitoring Cicero's private equity performance, it makes sense to segregate the portfolio into subcategories, which might provide better information to monitor. So, that's all I had planned for today before I was going to pass it on to Stepstone. But before I do that, let me pause for any questions for me.
All right. Thank you, Rishi. Are there questions or comments for Rishi on the presentation that we've had thus far? Sounds like you answered the mail, Rishi. I don't see any hands up. It's been very interesting, lively topic, timely and lively. So all good.
Thanks, everyone. So let me now pass it on to the Stepstone team. We have Tom Keck, Jose Fernandez, and Natalie Walker. They're all partners at Stepstone out of the La Jolla office in San Diego.
Right.
And they've all presented to Cicero Board in the past. So I'll hand it off to them now. Can we please make Natalie from Stepstone the presenter so she can share her screen?
Excellent. Thank you, Rishi. Let's see. Well, let's get everybody moved over. There's Tom. I see there's Natalie. Can't see Jose yet. Doesn't mean he's not here.
All right, we should all be here. Tom and myself will be leading the presentation. Can you hear me and see my screen?
We can hear you, Natalie, and we can see your screen. So welcome, and the floor is yours.
Great. Terrific. Well, I'll get it kicked off. I'm Tom Keck, the head of research and portfolio management at Stepstone. Nice to see you all virtually again. We'll try to move through this quickly. Glad to see that you're not shy and invite any questions along the way about what we've presented or anything else. So Natalie, why don't we move to the first slide? Terrific. So this is just kind of a summary. I'm going to go through the market overview, what we see happening across the private markets. Natalie's going to spend time on the pacing plan and private equity performance. Generally speaking, the private equity market was up about the same as the S&P during the third quarter. The numbers that we're going to show you in the performance update are as of the second quarter, but using some data that we have and a tool that we've created, we can kind of forecast what the overall market is likely to do up to a given date. So that's that 0.5% for the third quarter. The S&P was up at about 0.6%. So we've seen a dramatic recovery in the public markets since the first quarter of 2020. Private markets didn't go down as much as the public markets. They also have rebounded strongly, though. And so when we look at the comparison of private market performance relative to the public markets, we see that the delta, the spread between private markets and public markets has increased relative to where it was a year ago. So that's despite the high public performance, private markets have continued to outperform. We see a lot of deployment across private markets. And so 2021 is going to probably be a record across a number of different areas in private equity. Capital structures, thinking about buyouts, which is the focus of your program, tend to be very robust, given where we are in the market. We'll talk a little bit about valuations. I know there were some questions about that, and we'll look at leverage levels. And then we've seen very active IPO markets. The SPAC market was very active briefly. It sort of tailed off more recently. But that, has led to a lot of the distributions that you're seeing coming back on your portfolio and that we've seen come across all the portfolios that we manage. Natalie, why don't we move to the next page? So this shows the spread of private markets over public markets. The blue bars are for top quartile funds. The green bars are the median funds. And each year is a vintage year. So think about all the funds that were invested in that vintage year. So what this shows is that even the median private equity funds have outperformed in almost every vintage year over the last 20 years or so. And if you average it out, it's about 380 basis points of outperformance. So private markets have been a very good place to be for institutional investors, even if you aren't necessarily hitting the top quartile. You're getting pretty good performance relative to the public markets. We also see that the delta has gone from 320 basis points a year ago. This is the table in the upper right-hand corner of the slide, to about 380 basis points. So that spread has widened over the course of the past year. Next slide. So the next three slides, we'll talk a little bit about deal deployment from a couple of different sources. So this is global private equity buyout fundraising. So already in 2021, we've seen an increase over all of 2020. We may not get to where we were in 2019, but the fourth quarter is usually pretty busy. So it'll be close to an all-time high for private equity buyouts. Next slide. Deployment of capital has also been quite heavy. So year to date, we see that the equity invested across the private markets has been very strong. And the right-hand side of this page just shows the growth by region since 2010. So you can see that the increase in deployment over the last 10 years has largely come from a recovery in the US and from a deepening of the capital markets in Asia. Next slide. This is looking specifically at the US. And so the transaction volume in the US is already at a record high. Again, this is through the third quarter. So the fourth quarter is likely to just extend that even further. Next slide. In Europe, we see a similar trend, although they haven't hit the record levels that they hit back in 06 and 07. But again, we're only looking at three quarters of data here. So 2021 is likely to be a very strong year as far as capital deployment in Europe as well. If you take fundraising and capital deployment, the net of that is what we call dry powder. So this is how much capital is out there looking for transactions. You can see it's been on a fairly dramatic upward climb over the past 8 or 10 years. That 17% increase in dry powder just about matches actually the increase in NAV over the same time period. So on the one hand, you could look at this and say, geez, there's a lot of money looking for deals. On the other hand, this is really just sustaining the amount of capital that's needed to maintain the amount of net asset value that's in the asset class. So this is an area that we keep a close eye on. I don't think it's flashing red at this point, but it obviously is an area that we want to keep track of. As far as relative value in the private markets.
Tom, can I ask you a quick question?
Please.
So with all that dry powder out there and increased competition looking for quality investments, what are our expectations going forward with respect to return? There's only, maybe naive of me to say, but I think there's only so many great deals out there. When private equity first started, it was a niche with just abundant opportunities. But now, I just have some concern about, you know, where this is headed.
I think that's a valid concern. I think we've been projecting lower returns for the last 5 or 10 years, or expecting lower returns. Interest rates have stayed low. Multiples have continued to climb. And actually, Natalie, if we go to the next slide, we can kind of look at what has happened in valuation multiples. So the blue bars are for large private deals. The green bars are for smaller and middle-sized private deals. The orange bars is the S&P 500. So we're comparing the valuations in the private markets relative to the public markets. So back in 2015, valuations were about the same between the large end of the private markets and the S&P 500. Since then, the public markets have gotten more expensive relative to the private markets. The private markets are pretty expensive. So I think it's reasonable to assume a couple of things. Just from looking at this, equity returns are going to go down unless multiples continue to climb at the same rate that they have, which would be an unreasonable expectation. I think when we look at the capital structures, we see that the debt portion of the capital structure has been shrinking. So the amount of excess return you get just from leverage in the capital structure is also going to be smaller. So I think generally speaking, we're guiding towards lower expected returns in the next 5 to 10 years than what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years. But we think there's still a healthy spread in valuations between the private markets and the public markets. So we actually think that there's opportunity for continued outperformance relative to the public markets, even though absolute performance is probably going to be lower.
Okay, and then so I guess another justification with respect to our position in private equity would be diversification away from public equity.
So diversification is certainly a benefit that you get. So there's a stability component of private markets. The valuations are marked every quarter. They tend not to move as much as the public markets. So your overall volatility on the private portfolio isn't as high as for the public markets. The correlation between private markets and public markets, between private equity and public markets, is relatively high. It's about 80%. So you do get some benefit, some diversification benefit, because it's not one, but it's not as significant for private equity as it might be for, say, private real estate or infrastructure.
Thank you.
So this slide shows European purchase price multiples. It's a very similar story. Multiples have gone way up over the past 10 years. Part of that is due to interest rates coming down as dramatically as they have. Part of it is due to some of the earnings growth that our friends at Verisk were talking about this morning. Those two factors, I think there's just an overall increase in multiples. Equity markets are relatively expensive today compared to 5 or 10 years ago. This slide shows the capital structure for US buyouts. The blue bars are the leverage multiples for larger deals. The green bars are leverage multiples for middle market deals. So you can see that the larger deals tend to accommodate more leverage relative to the smaller deals. A different way to look at leverage, though, is to think about the equity percentage of the capital structure. And so the line charts show you the equity percentage of the capital structure. And so what you see here is that in both the large and small market, we've got a record percentage of the capital structure in buyouts is in equity these days. It's about the same in middle market versus large market. So that accounts for the spread in purchase price multiple that you see between those two markets. Basically, the amount of leverage that companies are able to get has leveled off over the last 8 or 10 years. And the increase in purchase price is coming almost exclusively from GPs putting more equity into deals in order to justify transactions. That sounds a little bit scary. On the other hand, the kinds of companies that therefore are trading are actually quite different. So we see this, the mix of types of deals skewing toward IT, financial services, healthcare, consumers, staples. So much higher growth, higher cash flowing businesses tend to be more what's getting purchased today than say 8 or 10 years ago. This again just shows what's happening in Europe, very similar trend there. This is a different way to look at capital structure. This is sort of the margin of safety. So the higher the interest coverage ratio, the less likely it is the company's going to run into financial distress. So you can see back in 2007, we were at a pretty low number. We're at almost double that number today. Now, interest rates are much lower today than they were back then. So that explains part of this. But a lot of it is that equity percentage of the capital structure that's going into these deals. So if there is a downturn in the economy, the capital structures that are in place in these deals are more survivable. And so you know, there won't be forced sales of private equity in a downturn, which we think is a positive for the asset class. You've heard that there's been a lot of cash coming back on your portfolio. A lot of it is coming from actual sales of assets, but we've seen dividend activity also be very strong. So this is a company has grown, is re-levering its capital structure and paying out a dividend to the shareholders. And as you can see, year to date 2021, this is through three quarters. So it's likely that we'll set a record this year for dividend activity in the US private markets. Secondary markets have also been very robust. This is essentially replacement LPs. So buying interests in existing private markets funds. Last year was a down year because of the downturn in the economy. We're on pace to be about $100 billion in transaction volume this year. So the liquidity available in trading out of primary funds is higher today than it ever has been. So that's the market overview. Let me just pause there and see if there are any questions for me before I turn it over to Natalie.
Don't see any, Tom, so we can continue. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I'm going to place a finer point on pacing as well as the portfolio performance. So a lot of this Rishi touched upon, and I had the pleasure of working kind of hand to hand with Rishi on the pacing analysis. So I'll probably just come at this from a little bit different perspective and add some additional color to Rishi's comments, because I think he hit the nail on the head with respect to the pacing. So for our pacing analysis, I wanted to make the point that we do this annually, if not more often. So this is an exercise where we take current market values of the total portfolio, as well as your private equity portfolio, and project into the future what we think you know, the percent of the private equity portfolio will be of your total portfolio in 5 to 10 years. And so as Rishi mentioned, we did this in connection with the increase in pacing from 11% to 15% that started with this fiscal year. And to do so, we decided to increase pacing, kind of going up to 300, 350 million in the outer years. In order to update our pacing, we took the updated values. So significant growth in the denominator or their total portfolio market value, as well as those distributions that came back to the plan in 2020 and 2021, means an increase in the recommended pace for the next 10 years. So the current pacing that we recommend for Contra Costa is about 450 million per annum. And we typically like to guide clients to a range around plus or minus 20%. That means, in a year where there's not enough available opportunities, you could do less than the pacing would suggest. In a year where there might be more attractive opportunities than the pacing would suggest, that you would increase your pacing accordingly. This also allows flexibility for different market conditions, whether they're favorable or not. So assuming that $450 million pacing, we project Contra Costa will reach the 15% target by 2029. So really kind of over the next 5 to 7 years. And the intent is to maintain that pacing over time and actually update the pacing analysis on an annual basis to reflect changes in those market values. Again, the strong growth of the portfolio, net positive, the sizable private equity distributions to Contra Costa, I'll touch upon in a few slides, but significant liquidity back to the plan has meant an increase in pacing over the next 5 to 10 years. And again, we will look to update this on an annual basis. We'll come back to the board with an updated pacing analysis next year. I did want to make the point, because there was a few questions on just how the strategy would change in order to put that capital to work. We are not recommending a change to the private equity strategy. So as Rishi mentioned, we'd like to continue to invest with first and second quartile managers. Over the past 5 years, we've invested with first or second quartile managers, top picks, and best performing large market funds. The intent would be to selectively add new relationships over time, as Rishi touched upon, which takes time to cultivate those relationships, and increase the total dollars committed to each fund with each subsequent fund commitment. So not holistically changing the strategy of the plan, but really growing with your existing core relationships and selectively adding new ones.
So let me stop you there. Natalie, Trustee Kwan has a question. Jay, you had your hand up.
Yeah, sorry for the interruption. Just a quick question maybe for staff. Given kind of the, 7 to 8 years before we get to the target NAV percentage, what's the alternative from an asset allocation perspective? What's going to be the kind of offsetting holding?
Is that a question for Tim?
Yeah, I think it'd be more for our staff, sorry.
Within our current structure, I mean, every time we have a private asset, we have a corresponding publicly traded asset as a parking place. In this case, it's U.S. equity.
Okay. Okay. And then is there any thought to kind of adding, backfilling or kind of shortening the timeline with the use of some secondary investments?
If Rishi's still on, Rishi, if you could come on and kind of address the thought process around secondaries.
Sure. So we haven't focused on secondaries so far. That doesn't mean that it isn't an area that we pursue. It's been sort of, what do we focus on first within the build out of the core primary fund portfolio? You hit the nail on the head there, Jay. The the benefit of secondaries is that you can get build your exposure quickly. The other side of it is that there can be also a more rapid return of capital. And so you might have good IRRs, but maybe you have multiples of invested capital that might be lower than some of your primary fund buyout commitments. But it is something that, you know, that I think it's a good suggestion, and I think it's something that we can look into.
Great, thanks.
All right, thank you, Natalie. Go ahead. Didn't want to interrupt you, but it was an important question.
Yeah, no, great questions. Any other questions related to pacing before we move to the portfolio performance?
Don't see any. So,
okay.
Go ahead. Great.
Well, I think to summarize, you know, a lot of good news in the portfolio, particularly for the last 12 months ended 6/30. So at 6/30, the PE market value is about $1.2 billion, or approximately 10% of your portfolio total market value. That includes about $1.6 billion of private equity commitments since inception across 17 managers and 52 funds. Importantly, you know, for the 6 months and rolled forward to 9/30 2021, the distributions to paid in crossed the 1x threshold, or 100% funded portfolio. So really kind of from this point forward, playing with house money. Also for the year, I'd focus on kind of two columns. Maybe the first column, the inception to June 30, 2021. And then also the last column on the far right, the annual change. So the total exposure today, $1.6 billion, includes the unfunded commitments to the more recent commitments in the core portfolio. And really the performance of the portfolio over the last 12 months, as well as inception to date, has been quite strong. So you see a total value to paid in multiple of 1.9x and a net IRR since inception of close to 14%. And that was really a significant increase year over year. So about 0.4x on the multiple and close to 300 basis points on the IRR. So really strong momentum, again, benefiting from public market growth as well as private market performance over the 12 months ended June 30. We also wanted to place a finer point on the sub portfolios that we have started tracking from a portfolio monitoring perspective. So historically, your portfolio at the time that we started working with Contra Costa was predominantly fund of funds. And at the point in time in 2017, when we started working with you, the intent was to take a more targeted approach, investing in direct primary fund commitments. So skipping that additional layer of fees that you would be paying to a fund of funds manager to go out and find primary fund commitments. Fast forward to today, you know, that core primary portfolio is growing. So that's the green portion of the circle on the right. Approximately 23% of your portfolio today, compared to about less than 70% of the fund to funds portfolio. Now, this includes both market values as well as unfunded commitments. So we're capturing, you know, the commitments that have not been invested yet. We also expect that 70%, as we mentioned in the pacing analysis, to continue to roll off over the next several years as those investments are exited. So that kind of takes me to how is the core primary portfolio benefiting Contra Costa today? And as you heard in Rishi's remarks, the performance has been quite strong. So 70% net IRR, which is really reflective of the performance since that program started investing with funds vintage 2019 and beyond, compared to the legacy fund of fund portfolio and the legacy primary fund portfolio of 14% and 12% respectively. Now you can see in the net IRR that the fund's total performance or the private equity's total performance is still tracking that fund to fund performance, but we would expect, you know, the core primary fund portfolio to continue to grow in size and be a more meaningful contributor to the bottom line performance of the private equity program. Taking us back to benchmarks at the total private equity level, we benchmark the portfolio against three benchmarks. So one is private benchmarks or the Burgess Private IQ private benchmark provider compared to the S&P 500 index or the returns that you would have generated had you invested in public equities instead, and then public index plus an illiquidity premium. So you can see the since inception performance on the far right, on the bottom, as well as in the green bar in the bar chart on the top, 13.8%. This compares to kind of 12.4% for median. So you are in the first and second quartile. And then the S&P return since inception of your private equity program of 10%. And the S&P 500 plus 400 of 14%. So over time, we have continued to approach, that S&P 500 plus 400 illiquidity premium and would expect that as the core portfolio continues to grow and the performance comes through in the total private equity performance that we would beat that high watermark of S&P 500 plus 400 basis points. In terms of valuation, as Tom mentioned in the market overview, we've seen significant valuation increases for the 12 months ending June 30. Part of that was just the depressed valuations that you were starting at June 30, 2020, kind of more or less bottom of the market related to COVID pandemic. But I would note that the net gains in the 12 months are meaningful on an absolute since inception basis as well. About half of your gains or half of your since inception gains occurred in the 12 months ending 6/30. So about $500 million in total gains compared to since inception net gain of $1.2 billion. So quite meaningful year for the Contra Costa private equity program. In terms of cash flows, this really kind of places a finer point on what we were talking about in terms of liquidity back to Contra Costa from the private equity program. Since inception, the plan has been net cash flow negative on a cumulative basis. So you can see in the orange line, cumulative net cash flows for the private equity program dating back 10 years. And up to year to date 2021. The green line reflects annual net cash flows, and the blue and gray bars represent contributions, so cash going out to private equity fund commitments or fund to funds and distributions coming back to the plan. You can see 2020 was a record year in terms of distributions coming back to the plan from the private equity portfolio. And year to date, 2021 through September has already crossed the amount received in 2020. Our forecast for 2021 year end is about $260 million. So we expect, again, 2021 to be kind of a record year in terms of distributions back to the plan. That's all positive. You know, a fund that had predominantly fund-to-fund exposures It's really nice to see that capital coming back to the plan and redeployed in higher performing strategies.
Natalie, the only thing I would add is the green line shows that the private equity portfolio is essentially self-funding at this point. So there was an earlier question about offsetting assets to fund the growth of the portfolio. And I think what you'll see is that green line will hover around zero or a little bit above zero as you grow the portfolio, so that you're at a really great point for an institution where the private portfolio is self-funding and will be contributing cash back to the overall portfolio going forward.
Excellent point.
We track the diversification of the portfolio. Now, there was an earlier question about diversification. This breaks down the diversification of the private equity portfolio specifically. And we break that down by a few different metrics. One, strategy. So you can see the private equity portfolio is predominantly invested in buyout investments, followed by venture capital, then fund of funds, special situations, and growth equity. Again, we try to break down all the fund of funds by each subcategory, unless they're just generalist fund of funds. On the fund type, again, break it down by type of fund. So whether it's a fund of funds, a primary fund, or a secondary, and again, would expect the primary exposure, this is off of market value, to grow over the next 10 years. We also look at it by investment manager and industry. It's not surprising that the top three exposures by investment manager or fund-to-fund managers, Adam Street, Pathway, and Sigler Gov. There are some core relationships on here as well, like Genstar that you have committed to twice, that's in your core portfolio, and would expect that these managers, kind of the core managers, to grow in exposure over time as they come back to market. We also look at diversification from an industry perspective, the highest exposure being IT. Again, IT touches a number of different subsectors, so not concerning and not dissimilar to what we're seeing across our other clients' portfolios with high IT exposure. That is followed by industrials and healthcare and consumer discretionary. The last slide here just touches upon the real assets performance. So again, as Reese mentioned, we will be breaking out the performance of real assets from private equity. This is mostly a legacy portfolio that is across real assets, timber, energy, and power. There are both fund of funds and funds in this portfolio. They range in vintage from 1996 to 2016. You can see the performance over time hasn't changed meaningfully, and we don't expect meaningful, if any, dollars going to the strategy going forward, but we'll continue to track the performance.
Natalie, let me interrupt you there. Jerry Holcomb, you had a question.
Oh, I think you're on mute.
Yeah, you're on mute, Jerry.
Hate to go back, sorry about that, but on your last slide, there's 10%, which is indicated in an industry as not classified. Hopefully that's not because we don't know what they do. But could you give us a little bit of flavor as to what might fall into that category?
Sure. So there are fund of funds that don't disclose the underlying exposures to StepStone, but I think they are tracked maybe by staff. So those are just industries that aren't being tracked from a reporting perspective or are marked as generalist.
I'm not sure that makes me feel better. It sounds like somebody who could staff step in here and not, you don't have to give us any details, but could you tell us that you know what they do?
Sure. Hi Jerry. Usually, so the dynamics here are that some fund of funds don't want to share this information with StepStone. In some cases, these fund of funds view StepStone as a competitor, and so don't want to disclose the underlying fund exposures. And so, you know, the funds that have that, they're diversified funds by sector. So it isn't all in one, all in IT or all in consumer staples or all in healthcare. There are the funds in that 9%, I'd expect to be multi-sector focused, and not all just in one sector or concentrated in one sector.
So are you satisfied on our side if they're not sharing this information with StepStone that we have enough information as to what they're doing, or is this just a black hole?
Yeah, no, it isn't a black hole. So when we have our quarterly updates with those funds, they share the unredacted versions of their quarterly reports that show us the sectors that they're in. But when they report out, they redact some of those reports, so it isn't easy to see what the underlying funds are and exposures are for a group like StepStone who's monitoring.
Okay, I feel marginally better.
The takeaway is because these are broadly diversified, you should expect it to have very little impact on the overall pie chart here.
Right, and I would just add, I mean, those are highly, highly diversified, if not over-diversified fund to funds, so not concentrated in any one sector or strategy. So if anything, you know, the diversification effect leads to lower risk.
Jerry's worried about the Ponzi schemes that he's familiar with.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a guy that I knew and worked with, not with any contribution, but he worked with a lot of angel investors in Silicon Valley. And he said something to me years ago that struck me as appropriate at that time, and it hasn't changed. He said, "Jerry, there's more money out there than there are good ideas." And that sometimes scares me a little bit, that somebody might say, "Hey, sounds like an idea. It may not be a good one, but we got to put the money somewhere." So I don't think his feelings have changed. I haven't talked to him in a while, but he said money was not a problem.
Plastics, Jerry. Just remember that. All right, Natalie, go ahead.
So I think that concludes our presentation. I think just in summary, think that the private equity program is performing very well. Very excited about the core primary portfolio that has been put to work over the last several years, and excited that for the first year we've been able to actually show and demonstrate performance across those managers. So happy to pause there and open for any questions.
All right, let's take a pause there. It is a good story, so it's always good news when it's a good story. Are there other questions or comments for Tom or Natalie?
Natalie?
Hi.
I just wanted to check on how StepStone facilitates relationship building for our investment team, since the relationships are so important.
Yeah, it's a great question. So as an advisor, we look to bridge the gap or provide introductions to your team. Your team does maintain direct relationships with each of those managers, but Rishi and our team sit down every so often and definitely at the outset of each year to discuss the forward pipeline and put together a list of kind of high target names that are on our top picks, and then also discuss maybe potential introductions that might be a couple years out from fundraising. And look to make introductions where appropriate, where there may not be an existing relationship.
Yeah, and just to put a little bit of a finer point on it, we've got 170 plus investment professionals spread across 19 offices, and they're divided up into specific sectors. So large buyout, small buyout, Europe, Asia, venture capital. And the responsibility of those professionals is to really know the relationships or know the GPs in their market that we want to have relationships with, and to facilitate those introductions directly with our clients. So the GPs actually prefer to have that direct relationship rather than to have us standing in between. So we actually get a better relationship with the GPs by facilitating better relationships between our clients and them. So it's kind of core to our strategy to have that as a model.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Any other questions for Natalie or Tom? I am not seeing any. So thank you both. That was very informative, upbeat. It's always nice to have good news, but lots of challenges in this area, notwithstanding that. So
thanks, everyone. Hope to see you in person next year.
Sure. Thank you both. And Tom, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
A week after Veterans Day, and I wanted to recognize that. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, all. Thank you.